This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and you are listening across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archive podcast of the program, and you're doing that on our HRN website, horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from my home studio. My producer, Lee Delapina, back in our main studio in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky, and really excited for this program here today. And, I'll start the show, and I'll tell you that one of my great pleasures is getting the opportunity to visit with some of the brand names in the sport, if you will. People like a Bob Baffert, a Todd Pletcher, a Kieran McLaughlin, for example, Graham Motion. But now I like to do something a little bit different today. And I like to every once in a while focus on a trainer that is just getting started. And this is a trainer, my guest here tonight, you very well may never have heard her name before, but that will change when she starts saddling horses on her own. She is yet to saddle a starter in her own name. She is a longtime assistant to trainer Gary Contessa, who announced his retirement, if you remember, in early March. She also spent about a year working as an assistant for trainer Wayne Catalano. Both of those individuals, Gary and Wayne, have been on this program, and I'm looking forward to hearing what she has learned from each of them and how she'll be using them in her operation now as she embarks on her own career. She's a native of New Hampshire who is now anxiously awaiting the resumption of racing at Belmont Park and that opportunity to saddle her very first starter in her own name. Please help me welcome Amira Shishakli to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here today. Amira, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is really cool. I really enjoy getting the opportunity to visit with people like yourself. And I have had many trainers on this program over the years that are just getting started. But very rarely do I have a trainer that is yet to saddle a horse. And that's the situation you find yourself in right now.
Yeah, it was a very interesting turn of events. Gary had timed the end of March to be sort of the end of his training career, and he couldn't have timed it better. I don't know if he saw this shutdown coming or what, but he's laughing now. He said, I set you up on purpose. but we ran our last horse at Tampa, and his name, it was on the 21st, and his last day training was the 25th. So after that, racing was shut down everywhere we had horses. So haven't been able to start anything yet, unfortunately.
When he came to you and told you that he was going to go ahead and retire, did you immediately think, okay, I want these horses, I want to do this?
Well, how bold of you to assume that he came to me and told me that?
Yeah, what was I thinking? I know, Gary. What was I thinking?
So pretty much what happened is he'd been discussing it for really probably the past year, either training less horses or backing off entirely. He hadn't fully decided. And at the beginning of March, he was really saying, I think it's time, but again, not firming up any plans. Next thing I know, I'm getting phone calls from like 50 different people. Oh, hey, did you see the article that Gary wrote about you and about he's retiring? I said, no, I haven't seen that yet. So he went and announced that before working out any details. And that's probably a smart thing. I think it worked in his favor. He got a lot of people asking him what his plans were and giving him offers and giving him suggestions. And then, you know, behind the scenes, we were kind of scrambling to figure out the actual details of it.
Yeah, somehow it's all come together, at least on your end anyway, because you are now in a position where you're taking over many of his horses. I don't know if you're taking over the whole barn, are you?
I mean, he told everybody pretty much March 1st, that this is what he was planning. He told the owners privately. So anybody that was looking to move the horses out did so throughout the month of March. So I came back to New York to a full barn of what essentially became just my horses. Not much changed since. He obviously has had a training. So anyone who was going to leave has left. But a lot of the owners are still here, and I'm very grateful to them for giving me that chance. And I feel bad for them that they now have to wait a few months to see what's going to happen when we race.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation at Belmont Park. And I don't know, Amira, if anybody knows exactly when racing will resume, do they?
No, I know the racing office had a few goal dates. First it was May 22nd, then it was May 29th. The problem is they're trying to work really hard with the state to come up with, what's the best way to start racing? Is the state comfortable with them racing? Are the right safety protocols in place? Today was the very first day that they started doing temperature screening on everybody in and out of the gates. They're trying to work with the state and do things the right way to open up. But until they get the go ahead, I don't think they could fairly say May 29th is their date.
How much more challenging is it for you trying to start your own operation and get this off the ground and do it the right way to have to do it under these types of circumstances? What challenges does that present?
Oh, definitely financial ones. But the other thing too is it's very hard, to make your own case, to say, look, I've been Gary's assistant for this amount of time, and I know this about horses. There's no statistics out there for me. I'm very honored for the owners that have stayed in this firm, but at the same time, I understand the ones that left because someone out there has had, 29 starts in the last meet, and they had four winners, and I have none of that. I have no records right now because we haven't gotten the starter. That's difficult, and it's difficult in terms of advertising too. And it's weird to talk to people about, do they want to have a 2-year-old, or would they be interested in having me as a trainer? Because we just don't know the future, so it's very hard to market myself or promote myself right now because we aren't getting results because we aren't running. So
yeah.
That changes the whole dynamic, I think. I do appreciate the pause time to be able to watch all the horses. And the first week here, a week or two that I was back here in New York, I just took the time to quietly evaluate all of them without asking them to do too much, and then made a plan for them. And that is something I probably wouldn't have been able to do to that degree, at least, if we were racing in the middle of this.
Yeah, one of the reasons that Gary cited, one of the main reasons for his retirement, and he joined me on this program right after he announced it to talk about his decision, was the fact that it was becoming increasingly more difficult to do business in the state of New York and even within the industry in some respects because of the regulations that are placed upon trainers in that particular type of business. Can you imagine, and I know you said he left maybe at the right time, but can you imagine what he'd be thinking right now with no racing? You talk about difficult to do business.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have the races and the purses, and it creates a huge financial burden.
Yeah, I know. Listen, anytime he calls me stir crazy from upstate New York, I remind him, if you were here, you would be really, you'd be in worse trouble than you thought you were before. So just be grateful that you washed your hands clean of this before, any of this sort of struck, and he laughs and says, yeah, you're right. It's interesting. Like, I'm getting killed by workman's comp, which is what all trainers get, I'm sure that everybody says this. I think my rates are too high, but we're not even racing. So I have payroll to pay. I have obviously got to pay for feed, for hay, for straw, and then workman's comp to pay. There's nowhere to get the return on anything except for day rate. And that's, you know, scraping my pennies every single day. I'm not going to be taking a salary for who knows how many months just to keep the business running.
Yeah, I guess that leads me to the next question then, Amira. Why make – of course, you don't know this is going to happen when you're making this move necessarily. You don't know it's going to go to this level with the pandemic. But why do this? Why not go do something else?
Well, you know, the week before so March 25th was Gary's end date. And in that week before, as I'm running through the numbers, as I'm trying to set up workman's comp, and as I'm also at the same time driving back from Tampa – every single day I'm going through that question. And one thing someone said to me was, well, if you don't do this, what else are you going to do? Because if they shut down racing, where else are you going to have a job anyway? So you might as well take this chance and go for it. But at the same time, there's also the fact that Gary walked away and left pretty much all of his equipment for me to use. It's like an unheard of situation. I'm very lucky for that. That's a ton of money that I don't have to invest into starting a business.
Yep, it makes a big difference. Talking with Amira Shashakli here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, she is going to be embarking upon that training career, as you've just heard, but she can't do it until racing resumes at Belmont Park. I asked you yesterday, Amira, well, why not just go someplace else and run horses at a track that's running now, like a Churchill, like a Gulfstream? But you pointed out the fact that it's not easy to get into those places right now.
Yeah, I mean, Churchill, I believe, is giving us sells based on who's been there, stable there beforehand. And then Gulfstream, we pretty much sent all of our horses north right before they shut down New York racing. So those owners have already paid for a van to go from Tampa Bay Downs to New York. Not sure how happy they'd be to ship from New York to Gulfstream to then run in those packed fields and then hear that New York racing gets opened again. So everybody's been pretty much on board to stay put at this point.
Had you been considering going out on your own, even when you were working with Gary before you found out that he was going to be retiring?
Probably not directly from Gary. Like, if I were planning to leave him anyway, or if I'd gone from him to another trainer, then possibly. You know, I usually only considered that when I was in an interim period. Like, when I left Wayne Catalano, I had an offer. Some great owner as well had said to me, do you want to take my three horses? And I actually declined him. I said, you know, it just doesn't make sense, especially starting with three, and I don't have the capital started up. Thank you so much, but I don't want to do that right now. So, you know, I always knew that if I got the opportunity to have more than, say, eight horses to get started, that was my line of where I could make it work, where I could afford it.
How many horses do you have now?
17.
Good number?
Yeah, I think it's a great number. I get to keep a close eye on all of them, work closely with all of them, and it's still enough that it keeps me interested and entertained every day.
I'm sure. What's been the most, I guess, rewarding part of being around the horses for you?
There's a couple. I'd say those quiet moments in the barn when pretty much no one else is there. And just that, I don't know, that feeling, listening to them munch on the hay and walking down the shed row and noticing little things about each one. You know, you miss a lot of that during the morning training and stuff when everything's moving around. And then one of the other things that really sticks to me is watching a horse get it, watching a horse go from, you know, trying to figure it out, trying to see what you're asking, to one day he's just like, bam, there's an amazing work, and he's aggressive into it, and he understands it. Or, you know, this filly just learned how to come out of the gate, where I remember the first day we took her, and she was like, what's going on here? You know, seeing that progress, that that is cool. When you can walk away from the track and say, wow, we finally got there. We finally accomplished this.
I have to tell you, Amira, that was like a little bit of a pep talk for me. I've never trained horses, never worked on the backside. But I've obviously talked to plenty of trainers on this program and other shows. But I am raising a puppy that is going to be 8 weeks old on Saturday. And I keep waiting for that moment when he says, yeah, I get it. So this actually happens, right? If I hold in there, this actually happens.
Well, you have to do the work in between, of course. It's little things every day. it's not just going to magically come up. But yeah, they're young horses. A lot of times we forget how young they are. To the rest of the horse world, these horses wouldn't even be under saddle. You know, they start horses when they're four. A two-year-old is a complete baby. You got to remember that too. Even these three-year-olds that have been on the track for a year, they're still young horses. They're still young minds. They're picking up on little things. They can pick up the bad habits just as quickly as they can pick up the good ones. It has to be constant little reminders and little rewards when they do the right thing, so that they know that, okay, this was it. And then that's where they're able to put all those pieces together to create that final product.
Yeah, I'm going to have to send my puppy up to New York. I'll supplement your income for you a little bit here. We'll pay you to train this puppy and just send him back when he's a two-year-old.
Done deal.
After he's broke. It'll be great. Amira Shashakli here on Trainer Talk. Go ahead, Amira.
Oh, no, I was just going to say my dog, when I got her as a puppy, I trained her to break out of the gate. I'd hold her and her toy and make her wait quietly, then open my arms, and she had to spring out. And she still knows that. And I also did, you whistle at the horses when they pee in the test barn.
Yeah.
I housebroke her by humming anytime that she peed, and then I would hum when I wanted her to pee outside. And that's how I housebroke her.
Wow, fantastic. Fantastic. I'm going to start humming. Actually, the housebreaking part wasn't all that bad. It's the rest of it that I'm dealing with. So we'll get past that, and I'll take the tips from Amira Shashakli here on Trainer Talk, and we'll see if that doesn't help. Tell me, Amira, a story or an example of a horse that you were working with. Could be any horse. It could be any breed. And all of a sudden, it looked like they were going to be a problem child, and all of a sudden, they just got it. Tell me an example of a horse like that.
let me try to think of someone specific. You know what might be fun for people to hear about is Manhattan Dan. I had him as a two-year-old at Aqueduct with Gary, and he wasn't so much a problem child, but he was a typical colt, big, thick, beautiful horse. He had a ton of energy, very powerful, but just not really fully directed in his mind and what we were doing all the time. And he did everything fairly willingly, but it was still like, oh, we're goofing off this way, we're goofing off that way. All right, maybe we're breathing, but I'm just looking at this other horse and having fun. So we had him. He was down to breeze 3/8 at Aqueduct, and I knew he was going to be leaving to go to the Belmont barn soon, too, which was a little sad for me because I could already see what kind of a good horse he was going to be. And I had him paired up with another colt that I knew he was better than, and I didn't want either one of them to feel like they lost. Mm-hmm. So I had the one colt. It was Extinct Charm, which Bruce Brown ended up with and did okay in New York. So Extinct Charm, I had him break off from the 3/8 pole, and I had it coordinated with my rider to have Manhattan Dan break off from the quarter pole so that they didn't hitch up until they were, going at the quarter pole, and Extinct Charm would win at the wire, and Manhattan Dan would win in the gallop out. Well, even though we had the riders really, really ready and on top of things planned out, and, the first one hit the 3/8 pole, and the other one was jogging the right way just before the quarter pole, getting ready. As soon as Extinct Charm came up near Manhattan Dan jumped straight up in the air and then had to catch him. He was coming about probably because he lost that time, three lengths behind him and had to catch him going down the stretch. They ended at the wire, probably Extinct Charm was like a nose in front, and then Nat and Dan just blew by him for the gallop out. But that was the moment that that horse clicked and said, I want to be a racehorse. I want to beat this horse. And he became a very good sprinting horse. I mean, you can look him up. but that was the moment that that horse changed, that horse got it, got that competitive feeling.
Yeah, it's a great story. Do horses know when they do something good, if they win a race or they do something you've been teaching them to do in a race? Do they come back and they kind of say, yeah, I did it? Is there a confidence there somewhere?
Yeah, I think generally, not always. There's some horses where, you know, you see them do something and they're like just sort of going through the motions, or even if they did it well, you're not sure if they fully know what's going on. But other horses, you see in them that they're like, okay, I'm proud of this moment. Like, that was the right thing to do. You know, I think most of the time, if it's a big change for them, they notice it.
Yeah, talking with Amira Shishakli here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. If you're just tuning in, she is just getting started with the training career on her own, although she has plenty of experience having worked with Gary Contessa for about 10 years. She was with Wayne Catalano for about a year as well. Tell me about that time that you were with Wayne for that 1 year. What year was it, and what was that experience like?
Okay, it was fall of 2016 into 2017.
Okay.
So that was the year that he had Feral. It was a very exciting year. But, you know, I didn't know much about him, and I sort of just walked into his barn and became his assistant. It was an interesting setup from the start. What's the quote? There's a thing in the office about how, a Michael Scott train of thought can derail and destroy the entire neighborhood if you don't catch it early. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what working with Wayne is. You have to sometimes get him back focused on something, or you're never going to catch up to where he is. I remember we were shipping out to Oakland, and he was still trying to make up his mind about which horses were going to go and, you know, figure out the races around Kentucky, at Turfway, or and the timing at Oakland for horses too, for their conditions, whether it's worth sending certain ones. And our event was coming in about an hour, and our vet was getting ready to leave for the day, and we had no health certs written. And I eventually had to write down the names with the health cert with the vet, and then walk back into the office and say, all right, Wayne, these are the ones that are going. There are a lot of moments like that, but there's always, anyone who knows him will tell you that there's a method to his madness. And that was the most interesting thing for me to watch. I said in my article that he would get up on the rail with the horses, and he might have told them something to do in the barn, but as soon as he's on the rail with the horse, he'd say, wait, come back here for a second. I actually want this horse to do this. And even as he was saying it, sometimes he would alter that as well. And, you know, occasionally the riders would get impatient about it, too. I'd be like, all right, wait, are you sure you want me to do this thing and not something else? but it was, you know, it showed you how in tune he was to his horses and how he wasn't so rigid and set in, oh, we have to do this today because I wrote it down yesterday that that's what the horse is doing. No, okay, I saw the horse come up today, and I didn't like how he looks, so let's back off him a little bit. Or he looks way too full of himself, he needs to do more, let's make him gallop two rounds, which they did sometimes at Keeneland. He would change it based on the horse, based on the day, and that's something you don't necessarily see as much anymore. You see a lot of people that get rigid in their schedules, and like they write down that a horse is supposed to breeze on Monday. Well, Monday comes along, maybe the horse isn't quite ready to, but Monday was the day, so they're going to breeze. And maybe they just don't get as much out of it that day if they're forced to. Whereas if you looked at them and said, you know what, let's give this horse another day or two, all of a sudden you're top in the work charts. So, that was something interesting from him that I learned, and it wasn't necessarily easy to follow where he was going at any given time. But if you paid attention, it was definitely worth it.
Yeah, there's two recurring themes that seem to come up quite often on these trainer talk shows, and they have for more than 8 years now that I've been doing this particular program. It seems like trainers will say, in order to be successful, you have to be willing to treat every horse individually. Every horse is a bit different, and you also have to be patient. Are those the two keys, Amira, to being a good horse trainer?
Yeah, absolutely. They aren't machines. It doesn't mean you have to walk in and think that everyone's a pet, and not to call anyone out, but as a woman in this industry, I have had people that say, "Oh, your heart's too much in the game," or "Oh, you think of them too much like pets, the racehorses." You don't have to do that to treat them as individuals. There's a big difference. You can still be very calculated business-wise and understand that you're working with a living creature and that it's going to have good days and bad days. It's going to have little things that aren't quite right, and it can't speak to you. So you have to be looking around and waiting for those cues to appear so that it can tell you what's going on. And a lot of times there's subtleties. So if you aren't paying attention to the individual horse on any given day, you're going to miss those subtleties until they're not so subtle, and all of a sudden you have a problem.
Yeah, so, and flip this around too, Amira. Yeah. You talk about being a female trainer. This is a male-dominated sport, whether you're a jockey or a trainer, whatever it might be. There's no way around it. But flip that around. I've also had many female jockeys and other female trainers kind of tell me that there's this a lot of people believe that horses respond better to them because of the fact that they have this, I don't know, I guess I'll use the word nurturing sense that horses can pick up on. Is that true?
Well, just to be equally a little biased here, I would say that. I believe that. I've seen it. It's not a given rule, but I definitely think that women can get some responses out of horses that guys just can't. Like, I had Katie Davis riding for me as a gallop rider at Aqueduct, and there are things that she could do with certain horses that if I put a guy rider on, forget it. It just wasn't going to happen. But I think that ties into the fact that women are typically more intuitive, and horses are incredibly intuitive animals. They have to be for their survival. In a herd, those little tiny subtle signals are what keep them alive. So it's just a matter of being able to read those, and women, I think, are a little bit more in tune to that naturally to start off with.
Yeah, fascinating conversation here on Trainer Talk today with Amira Shashakli. Again, for somebody who has never saddled a horse in her own name, it sounds like she has her ducks in a row and she knows her stuff, and can't wait to visit with her in the second half of the program. Stay with me. When I come back, we'll talk more about her background, her upbringing, and working around other breeds, and we'll also tell you about a very special filly she had the chance to be around and showcase her talents as well. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you can't lose.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the Phipps in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Time-tested Broken Vow continues to deliver quality black-type stakes horses at a 15% clip. The top son of Unbridled has sired over 150 black-type horses, 80 black-type winners, and over $75 million in earnings. Among the 12 black-type horses sired by Broken Vow in 2019 was dual Canadian Classic winner Tone Broke, winner of classic races on dirt and turf. Also the sire of Imprimis, the Speedy Keeneland graded stakes winner of over $440,000. Give your mare a great start with a proven sire. Broken Vow, standing at Pin Oak Stud.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And they're into the stretch. Laverdad off the turn in front. Room for Me is two lengths behind. Dame Dorothy has now moved up and takes second. Laverdad set down for a final furlong here. Trying to hold off Dame Dorothy, and on the outside, Wavell Avenue is closing in too, but it's Laverdad, Wavell Avenue, Laverdad in the Gallant Bloom. Over Wavell Avenue, Dame Dorothy was third, and Room for Me was fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, visiting with Amira Shashakli, who is just getting started with that training career. Going to tell you more about that right after I remind you that if you missed any portion of this show or any of our shows, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast at your leisure. Also follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. That was Larry Colmus with the call of the 2015 Grade 2 Gallant Bloom Handicap at Belmont Park. And you might be wondering, well, why are you playing a clip of Laverdad, who was obviously an unbelievable New York bred, as we know, lost a battle with colic this past weekend, had to be euthanized. That's heartbreaking for all of us. But why are you playing that clip? Because Amira or Gary Contessa or Wayne Catalano didn't train Laverdad. It was Linda Rice. But Amira, you had a very special tie to Laverdad, if you will, because of another talent that you have, which is painting. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I wasn't really ready to play that clip, and I actually just got a little bit emotional. She was a great New York horse, and she kind of came into my life when she was a broodmare more, because I started working for Lady Sheila by doing all of her social media. And when, after that connection had formed, probably about a year or so after, one of the photos that we had taken at the farm, at Addition Farm, Kathy Landman actually took it, was just so touching. I decided to paint it, and it was Laverdad and her tappet filly, who went on to sell for $800,000 in November, weanlings. I decided to paint that and give it to Sheila as a gift. So Sheila got that for her birthday that year, and now it's probably a little bit more touching because we've unfortunately lost her. And to add to that connection, after I did my first sort of, I guess, official interview on Sunday, I got the call from Sheila that Laverdad had to be euthanized. And it was that night that I had to sit down and decide to write something that would both be, straightforward and announce what had happened, but also sort of give credit to that great mare. So I'm not sure if people have seen it or not, but there is a post that was sent through Facebook that is Our Lady Sheila statement on Laverdad's passing. And that's what she had me write that night.
Yeah, so difficult, and she was certainly a great champion, and that painting, and I don't even know if I was looking at the right painting, but I'm going to assume I was, Amira. When I was getting ready for the program, doing some homework, some research, you have a Facebook page, and there is a painting, and again, I'm going to assume it was her. Is it the one with the black background with her leaning over toward the foal? Is that the right one?
So there's a new Marinville painting that I just started.
Okay.
But the one where she has her head pretty much wrapped around the chestnut foal, that's the one that went to Sheila.
Yeah, beautiful work. And happen to flip through some of your other paintings as well. It's not just horses. Was there a lion painting that I saw there too?
Yeah, I love doing wildlife too. And then also the horses. I love to do anatomical drawings and paintings. So I like to do some that will show multiple layers at the same time. Both, oil, I can do that, but I have to sort of decide which parts I show. And then watercolor, because it's transparent. I've done a few of those where I paint the skeleton first, paint the muscle layers next, and then paint the skin over. I like doing those as well.
Yeah, you're super talented. The paintings were beautiful. Did you go to
Thank
school
you.
For that, or was it something that just came naturally?
I was pretty self-taught. I actually didn't do it too much when I was younger. I was always doodling or doing some form of artwork, but I didn't try to work on animals seriously probably until my senior year of high school. I was just always afraid I was going to misrepresent them, not do them well enough. So I didn't do that until then, and that was still drawings. And then paintings I've probably only been doing for about 7 years maybe. And I started with the wildlife on those and then went to the horses.
Yeah, is there a calendar that you put together too?
I do, yeah. Every year I take what I've completed in the last year for artwork and I put it together as a calendar. And those are for sale about as soon as I get them organized. Some of them end up being right in the last week of December. But, when I'm together, I get them ready at the end of November for people to have for the next year.
They're beautiful. Where do you sell them? Go ahead and give yourself a little plug.
Well, I usually just advertise it on Facebook on my artwork page there, which is Head Heart Hoofbeats Online Gallery. I have it separate because for me, it's about making an opinion, having an opinion about the art first, the painting first, or having a feeling about it, and not necessarily connecting to a name. So I don't have my name on there except sort of off to the side. The majority of my artwork goes up on there, and that's where I'll sell my calendars. I'll also usually go through and post a video on my personal page when the calendar's ready, showing you what's in it, and I do a raffle. Like if someone enters to win, then they get a chance at a free calendar. They just have to share the video, like the video, or whatever the qualifications are that I put up.
How are you going to find time to paint when you're running your own business and your own stable now?
Pretty much the same way I did when I was an assistant, getting zero sleep too. It's interesting. I just don't sit still too much. Any second of my day that I have free, I tend to fill with one thing or the other. So, while you might finish your day up, whether it's a long day or a short day, and go home and watch TV, watch Netflix. I might have the same setup, but I make sure I put a paintbrush and canvas in front of me while I'm doing that. And this is still work time. Keep going. It's not late enough yet for you to just sit here and watch.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Amira Shockley with me here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. It's not only about painting for you. You spent a couple of Belmont Stakes working as an assistant to the New York Racing Association photographer and helping do some photography too.
Yeah, and that's a lot of fun too. And it's another way to, have horses on the mind or see things differently in the sport. There's so many things that you see when you're photographing races versus when you're just there to watch your horse race. Things that you notice with jockeys, things that you notice at the starting gate, things you notice about the surface even. I started for him a few years ago. He'd ask me here and there, hey, do you want to take a few pictures in the paddock of, I need this jockey, that jockey. Would you like to shoot the finish for this race? Would you be able to do the turn for the wood? And then eventually that turned into a spot where he pretty much has me a retainer for any Belmont stakes he wants, where I shoot the roof and then I go and I shoot the first turn. And for whatever reason, that spot fits for me, and I do the first turn at Saratoga as well. So it's just whenever it ends up working in the schedule, I go running over, flying over. I could have a horse running that day too. Take the shots and then go running back to the barn.
Yeah, I can imagine one of the more rewarding moments for you is going to be when you have to tell Adam, no, I can't do this because I have a horse in the Belmont Stakes.
Right. Well, we'll wait on that day to come. But something tells me that I might still be there with a camera.
Yeah, I'm sure you will, and that would be quite a moment if we can get to that point. But, again, we've got to get racing back in New York first and do it safely and with the interest of all involved, including the horses and the humans who are around them, too, and make sure we do this the right way. Hopefully that will happen soon, and Amira can get started with her career. Take me back to the beginning, Amira. Where did this love of horses begin for you?
Well, I don't think I had much of a choice in the matter, honestly. I grew up with horses in New Hampshire, as was already stated. And probably we had four or five on average when I was younger, and that developed into having close to 15, but a lot of them Welsh ponies because we started a Welsh pony breeding program. My brother and I both started riding when we were younger, but on bigger horses. We had a quarter horse Arab that both of us learned on. And my brother started to get a little bit intimidated of horses and sort of uninterested and backed away. And that's when my parents went out and bought a small pony, and that's what gave them the idea that, oh, we should breed Welsh ponies because we want people to be interested in horses, and some people just can't get brave enough to be around the big ones. I was always mucking stalls, moving hay in the summer. Oh man, if it were a dry, sunny day in June, you were hiding somewhere because you knew you're gonna be like, hey, we gotta go pick up 200 bales of hay. You were gonna get that call from one of your parents saying, let's go. Go pick it up at Harold's. He called us and said he has it ready. Like, no, I'm at a friend's house. Thank you.
Wow.
But, it's always in the field with the horses. There's work time in the barn, and that's when you had your boots on and your helmet and all the right equipment. But the rest of the day, I'd be in the field with them barefoot, going up to them barefoot, not really caring, playing with their manes, them loose in the field. I probably could have been kicked about 100 times, and I never was.
Well, for people that aren't familiar with Welsh ponies, explain the difference between the thoroughbreds you work with now and a Welsh pony.
About 2 feet.
How about mentally?
Not
Is there
not,
a difference?
Not that extreme, but... So the Welsh ponies that we bred were usually around 12-2 hands, and that's a hand is 4 inches for people that don't know, whereas most of the thoroughbreds are 15 hands and taller. Welsh ponies, the reason we chose them is because they probably are one of the more athletic breeds of ponies. A lot of people use them in hunter jumper circuits, or they'll cross them even with thoroughbreds to use them in hunter jumper circuits, because for small animals they pack a big punch. And I think in that way they're a little similar to thoroughbreds in that they have that athleticism and they have that spirit, so to speak, but they are still a million times quieter than a thoroughbred and much, much safer, especially trained right. A thoroughbred, on the other hand, from the first 5 seconds is up and running around. you know, they don't waste much time or much energy in getting started. And then they, you know, you're not working with a quiet thoroughbred until they're probably about 10. So it doesn't matter how well trained they are or how kind they are. They're just always going to be on the muscle till they're much older, whereas a Welsh pony is very docile, very kind.
Yeah. What type of horse were you riding when you did dressage?
I had an Arabian mare, and
okay.
she was wonderful. And then I also had an off-track thoroughbred that was released to me, and I spent 2 years with her doing that.
What led you to the racetrack and to thoroughbreds?
I mean, I think it's something that you all, if you like horses at all, you always watch the Derby every year, and that's something that you can't quite get out of your mind, is that the excitement of that type of race and just horse racing in general. There's also the big influence of all the Black Stallion books and stuff. I wouldn't say any of them necessarily pushed me towards horses, racehorses, but I'm sure it definitely influenced. But it was really, I went to Saratoga, and while I was in Saratoga, I had someone say, you know, you can go work there if you want. And they sort of told me, like, who to go talk to, who to go ask for a job. And it sort of blew my mind that I could go work with racehorses, because I thought that was something, me in a small world, thought that was something you could only go do if you went to Kentucky. And at that time in my life, Kentucky was way too far to go to. Mm-hmm. And then it was, you know, such a delight to find that much closer to home, because Saratoga is only like 2.5 hours from New Hampshire.
Yeah, it's not that far at all. That's where I cut my teeth on racing, too. I grew up in western Massachusetts, so it was easy for me to make the trip over to Saratoga. It was a little bit over an hour away. And
yeah.
I can remember, back to your photography days, I can remember just going to the races, and I didn't have much money to bet with at that time, so I would take a camera with me, and I still have photo albums of horses from when I started getting into it in the late 80s, early 90s, and I still have those photo albums today of pictures I took with horses on the track. It's so cool.
Yeah, I think that the first few times I was ever at the racetrack in Saratoga, I was there with a camera. Both times I was with a friend, and I was like, hey, come check this out with me, please. And we made the trip from New Hampshire to do it, and we were making $2 bets.
Yeah.
$2 bets and taking photos, and that was pretty much it. But it's such an amazing experience in Saratoga anyways, that if you weren't looking to get hooked, you would anyway.
Was there a racehorse, Amira, that kind of roped you in, that you fell in love with, and you said, wow, this horse is really cool, and kind of got you even more hooked in some respects?
One that I saw personally, or just a famous one?
Yeah, one that you saw personally, or maybe even watched on TV when you said you were watching the Derby growing up in New Hampshire.
Well, I always liked Funny Side, but in person, I got to see Morning Line run in Saratoga at the very beginning of his career, and I have some photos of him too, and I loved him then. And so he's always sort of stuck with me a little bit. I didn't necessarily follow his career like glue. I think at the time I didn't even fully know how to. But, you know, it's definitely a horse that I think of when you ask that.
So how'd you get the first job on the racetrack?
I did what I was told to do and walked barn to barn. it's funny because probably the first place I stopped at said, I hear Gary Contessa is looking for someone, or ask there, because he's always, you know, willing to get people started, or, you know, whatever it is. So that's what they said to me. And I remember going by that barn, and, you know, in Saratoga, there's like those 3 or 4 barns by the kitchen all in a line. It's
yeah.
not the most picturesque place, and you got the dormitories there too. And I remember walking, the first time I walked by, there were a bunch of people at the picnic tables hanging out. And I kept walking. I didn't even stop. I was like, I don't know if yes, I want to go to this barn. And I kept going. And I went to like four or five other people that said, go check with Gary. And I finally went back. And that, you know, the rest is history. I started there. I didn't start with anybody else.
You know, starting at Saratoga is a little bit like jumping into the major leagues and being signed by the Yankees and starting at Yankee Stadium in some respects, right?
Well, I'm sure it's very parallel to starting as a trainer and starting in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great story and a story of perseverance, too, because you didn't get into the first barn that you went to. You had to keep at it, and thankfully Gary Contessa was willing to give you a try. So what you started out, what, walking hots?
Yeah. For me, it was very weird because I was used to doing everything. You know, if I wanted to ride my horse, I was getting my horse ready. I was riding it, then I was cooling it out, and then I was feeding it later. You know, there was no compartmentalizing of anything. So seeing the setup at the track was a new one for me, and I hadn't had much, you know, exposure to it one way or another. So I wasn't prepared for that. So people, honestly, they're asking me, like, what do? Do you hot walk? I'm like, what is hot walk? I said, I can do anything. Well, of course, if I had someone walk into my barn today and they told me they can do anything with a horse, it's like, you're going to start as a hot walker because you can hold this horse. So that's, yeah, I started as a hot walker. And then, you know, within the first few weeks, they put me on the pony because, you know, I'd said, oh, you know, I ride. Can I go out and ride? And so I started there with riding and hot walking.
Yeah, but don't you think that that's probably benefiting you now, and it's probably the best way to learn if you're going to eventually make a living in a certain sport or an industry? I did the same thing when I first moved to Kentucky. I could handicap, and I could bet on horses, but other than reading a racing form, I really didn't know. I hadn't been around horses. I hadn't worked around horses. I had some experience on the business side, but that was it. And I can remember, I still used to say that a horse was out of Seattle Slough. A horse was, you know, out of Mischief, instead of saying buy Into Mischief. And I had to learn all of the terminology. It sounds like you did the same thing coming up from a hot walker all the way through.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there were a lot of things where I'd be like, this is just called that, you know, because it was different inside the racing world and outside the racing world. And then there are other things that I'd never seen before, never heard of before. And, you know, just for me, I think being a hot walker was important and useful and something I enjoyed because you get to feel the subtleties of the individual horses that you walk. But in the meantime, you get to see everything that's going on. You get to watch without having to be necessarily the one making the decisions or involved or around a critical situation. But you get to watch. You get to watch how people respond. You get to watch how the horses react. And I think a lot of my learning happened there. And I definitely spent a lot of time every single day around the barn, even after we were done. And I got to see them check the horses after training. And then see the bridles get put together for the races, things like that. And, you know, a lot of it was me just sitting there quietly and watching. And it didn't matter what I knew or didn't know about horses at the time. I think that was the most important thing for increasing my knowledge and getting me set up for the future. I think grooming is good, too, because I did spend some time, well, over the years, of course, especially when we haven't had help. But, you know, starting off, I did spend some time like, oh, do you want to groom this one extra horse that we have? Doing that, I think, was a very, very good and helpful learning process, too, because there are certain things that you learn beyond the basics that some old-timer is going to show you that no one else is ever going to show you in the future.
Yeah, we've all had mentors in whatever it is that we're going to do in life, and I certainly have on the radio side, and I can still remember certain phrases or advice that I received from those people. How about for you, Amira? What are some of the, maybe the biggest piece of advice or a couple pieces of advice that you received from somebody as you were on this journey that you're now going to use to help you as you launch your own operation?
Let me think a second on ones that would be maybe specific to Gary, but there's one that someone said to me recently. I don't know if I should say call him out on the show or not, but he's a good friend of Gary's, and he has a farm in Ocala. But he said to me recently, he said, I wish you the best of luck. You got to remember one thing. And I said, what's that? He said, when you come to work in the morning, you need to bring a glass mason jar with you. And I said, okay, how come? He said, bring that glass mason jar in the office, open it up, put your heart in it, lock it up, and walk back out on the shed row. I said, oh, okay. He said, because if you work with your help without doing that, you are never going to be able to be as firm as you need to be to get done with the horses the things that you want done. Because they will try every step of the way to cut one corner or the other because they don't understand necessarily why you're asking them to do something, or they don't understand the passion of where you're coming from because it's not their business, it's yours. So I think that was, you know, that kind of hit hard for me because it's true. You have to remember that everyone, you know, they're here. They do love the horses. They do enjoy this. But at the end of the day, they aren't their horses. And when you're the one making the call, you have to make sure things get done right. And you have to be able to be the one drawing the line in a very firm way, whether it's fun or not. I think that was something that recently stuck with me.
Yeah, it's great. It's great advice, Amira, and something that is definitely going to help you moving forward. There's no doubt about it. Looks like we're down to about the final 2 minutes in the program. Believe it or not, this hour has flown by. We'll have to do a part two once you start getting a few winners out there. We'll bring you back on. We'll do a part two and see what that experience has been like. But I like to end the program quickly by asking trainers to tell me just something about them. We talked about your photography and your painting and those things that you get into, but what other hobbies or interests do you have?
I just like to learn anything and everything. I got Coursera and Udemy on my phone, and if I have a spare minute here or there, I'll open it up and I'll look at a course, or even if I'm walking a horse, cooling a horse out on the shutter or something, I'll have that playing and I'll listen to it and I'll try to learn something off of that, and languages. I have Rosetta Stone. I love learning languages. I'm definitely fluent in Spanish, but I'm familiar with French, Russian, Arabic, and very basics of Mandarin Chinese. But I just love learning, whether it's about horses, whether it's about languages, history, anything, sciences.
Wow. How about the name Amira? Where did that come from?
That's actually Arabic.
Okay.
It means female leader in Arabic.
Perfect. Perfect. And that's what she's going to look to do going on with this new career. Amira Shashakli here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Amira, it has been a delight to hear your story, and this visit has been so enjoyable. We'll remind people they can go to our website, horseracingradio.net, to check out the podcast, this entire show. And all the best moving forward. Let's get racing back at Belmont Park, and let's get this career started.
Thank you.
All right, Amira Shashakli, Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Been fun. Again, head back to our website and check out that podcast. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.